Tonight, the last of three installments from the annual lecture series titled The Fascination with Jewish Tales by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight we hear The Time of the Uprooted. Introducing Professor Wiesel is the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack.
I'm pleased to introduce Elie Wiesel tonight. We are told that when the biblical Sarah heard about Abraham's trial, about the impending sacrifice of her child, Isaac, she died. Did she die of horror, of incredulity, of shock? We don't know. We do know that while Abraham was prepared to sacrifice his son, it was his wife whom he lost. And so it is not a wonder that the Bible spends a whole chapter on his dealing with Sarah's death. It describes his detailed preparations to escort her out of the world, his efforts to create a funeral and sepulchre for her, his need to eulogize her. How does one live with losing one's wife when it is one's child that one has agreed to sacrifice? Abraham did not leave us a set of memoirs. We can only imagine how haunted he was by this ostensible last-minute substitution. We can imagine him consumed with an inconsolable grief, with guilt, devastated, withdrawing from the world. But that's not what happened. In the very first biblical verse following the narrative of Sarah's funeral, we read, I quote, "And Abraham was old, well stricken in age, and the Lord blessed Abraham in all things." And later we read that he died content. I quote, "And Abraham expired after a fine old age, old and satisfied, and was gathered to his people." End quote. Abraham eventually returned to a good life and was able to live it well. Something here Elie Wiesel has learned from Abraham. In the almost 30 years that I know him, in the midst of his being the most consistent and demanding witness of the most unspeakable crimes civilization has ever wrought, in the midst of being the voice of memory for these horrors, his impact on his students as on his readers and friends never fails to be positive, never fails to be uplifting. With this shadow never far from him, he unfailingly manages to help everyone believe in themselves and in the promise of the future. Ladies and gentlemen, my pleasure to introduce my friend Elie Wiesel.
The motto is from a man named Paritus, the one-eyed, and he writes a letter to a lost disciple, and it goes like this. "Look, young friend and brother, do your eyes see the young woman with a grave manner, the one who is destined to you? See how she leans her head to her left as if seeking your hand on her shoulder. See the dream of mystery and desire that hovers over her beautiful and melancholy face. That dream is yours. Look, and you will know what it is to love, but it will be too late." Whenever we have the words "too late," of course, it means tragedy. And therefore, the story here that I am about to tell, which I try to tell in this volume, in this book, has good moments, but also despairing moments. And since it deals with something which is so current, so part of our daily life, not only here, but anywhere and everywhere, it's called the time of the uprooted. Of course, it has some tragedy in it too. And this is the beginning, the opening. I am 4 years old, or maybe five. It's Sabbath afternoon. Mother is lying down in the next room. I'd asked her to read to me from the book she had by her side, but she has one of her frequent headaches. So I asked my father to tell me a story, but just then there is a knock at the door. Go see who it is, says my father, reluctantly glancing up from the journal he is keeping. A stranger is at the door. May I come in, he asks. A big, bearded man, broad across the shoulders, with sad eyes, there is something disturbing about him. His gaze seems heavy with secrets and glows with a pale and holy fire. Who is there, my father asks, and I reply, I don't know. Call me a wanderer, the stranger says, a wandering man who is worn out and hungry. Who do you want to see, I ask, and he says to me, you. Who is it, a beggar, my father asks. Tell him to come in. No matter what the hour, my father would never deny his home to a stranger seeking a meal or a night's shelter, and certainly not on the Sabbath. The stranger comes in at a slow but unhesitating pace. Father stands to greet him and leads him to the kitchen. He shows the stranger where to wash his hands before reciting the usual prayer, offers him a seat, and sets before him a plate of chont and challah. But the stranger doesn't touch it. You are not hungry, my father says. Oh, yes, I am hungry and I am thirsty, but not for food, says the stranger. Then what is it you want? I want words, and I want faces, says the stranger. I travel the world looking for people's stories. I am enchanted by the stranger's voice. It is the voice of a storyteller. It envelops my soul. He continues, I came here today to put you to the test, to measure your hospitality, and I can tell you that what I have seen pleases me. With that, he gets to his feet and strides to the door. Don't tell me you are the prophet Elijah, says my father. No, I'm no prophet, the stranger smiles down at me. I told you, I'm just a wanderer, a crazy wanderer. Ever since that encounter, I have loved vagabonds with their sacks full of tales of princes who became what they are for love of freedom and solitude. I delight in madmen. I love to see their crazed, melancholy faces and to hear their bewitching voices, which arouse in me forbidden images and desires. Or rather, it's not the madness itself I love, but those it possesses, those whose souls it claims, as if to show them the limits of their possibilities, and then makes them determined to go further, to push themselves beyond those limits. It's second nature with me. Some collect paintings, others love horses. Me, I am attracted to madmen. Some fear them and so put them away where no one can hear them cry out. I find some madmen entertaining, but others do indeed frighten me, as if they knew that a man is just the restless and mysterious shadow of a dream, and that dream may be God's. I have to confess that I enjoy their company. I want to see through their eyes the world die each night, only to be reborn with dawn, to pursue their thoughts as if they were wild horses, to hear them laugh and make others laugh, to intoxicate myself without wine, and to dream with my eyes open. So tonight, for the third encounter this year, I'm just reading to you a book that just came out, and in French it came out 4 years ago, but you know the translation and how it is. And as always, as faithful to our tradition here, I will interrupt the reading and make some preliminary but necessary remarks. First, of course, I want to thank Rabbi Polak, who is a colleague and friend, and to study with him each time I come here, at least during the months that I am here, is always a pleasure. It's enlightening. And he has built a Hillel house here, which is the best in America. And personally, I'm waiting for his book when he will write it on Westerbork, which he comes from. He was 3, 4, 5. In those years, he has a lot to say and many stories to tell. And, of course, I want to thank my colleagues. My colleagues here Department of Philosophy, Department of Religious Studies, university professors. They have now made the university a very great institution, one of the best in the country. And I think are proud to be here with our students. And so how can I not take my students of both courses? It's a joy. It's a joy. One class is about banned books. Why are certain books banned? Why were they? Among the books that we study is Anderson's Tales. Now, can you imagine that the fairy tales were banned? Why should fairy tales be banned? So we discussed it. We had an extraordinary session. And the other one is text, tales, stories, sayings by Rabbi Nachman, the great Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, the greatest storyteller of the Hasidic movement, and perhaps the greatest storyteller, period. They gave me joy, they give me joy each time I am with them, and that joy remains with me. I also want to thank, of course, those who are responsible for these encounters. It's on my staff, it's Irene and my very able assistant, Rachel Strauss. Then I want to thank Amy Bottomley, Judith Sandonato, Jolie Anderson, and the staff of the all university programs, the president's host, conferences, and their services, and the sign language interpreters who are so movingly good when they have to translate sometimes very complicated texts. Thanks to the police department, and especially John Ryan, who were all responsible for our security. They spend days and nights watching over us in these turbulent times. And again, I hope that we shall meet again next year. For the moment, what are we talking about? We are talking about uprootedness. What is to be uprooted? What does it really mean to be uprooted? And I'm telling a story here, of course. It's a novel. And the story is about one day a man named Gamliel is summoned to a hospital to meet a woman who is sick, very sick. And the problem is that she speaks only Hungarian. And in those places, there was no one in the hospital who spoke Hungarian. My character spoke Hungarian, so therefore he came. And on the way, he said, who could that woman be? Who could she be? And he tries to remember in his mind all the women he had met in his life. There weren't that many. First of all, of course, I describe his mother, and then also a woman, marvelous woman. Her name was Ilona. She was a cabaret dancer. And during the war in Budapest, when the deportation began in 1944, his mother entrusted him, Gamliel, as a child, to the cabaret dancer. And she saved him. So he thinks it must be she. And therefore he speaks about that, how she saved him and what kind of person she was. Today you would say she was a righteous Gentile. There are so few of them. But those who did show courage, they deserve all our gratitude. Now, why did I write another novel? I want you to know it's a pertinent question. Why should one write another novel? I remember reading about it, and I think I even met when somebody, a bookseller, said to somebody who came into his book, would you like to buy this book? He said, I have already a book. So I already have a novel, many novels. Why should I write another novel? Why does one write? So I'll read you a few things about writing in general. Why does one write? Why do I write? Perhaps in order not to go mad, or on the contrary, to touch the bottom of madness. Like Samuel Beckett, I believe the survivor expresses himself, what we say in French, en désespoir de cause, because there is no other way, in desperation. So like him, I speak words, write words, sometimes reluctantly against words. Believe me, there are easier occupations, far more pleasant ones. But somebody like me, writing is not a profession but a calling, an honor according to Camus. As he put it, I entered literature through worship or adoration. Other writers have said through anger, through love. As for myself, I would say through silence. It was by seeking, by probing silence, that I began to discover the perils and the power of language. In truth, in the beginning, when I wrote my first memoir, I never intended to be a novelist. The only role I sought was that of witness. I believed that having survived by chance, I was duty-bound to give meaning to my survival, to justify each moment of my life. I knew the story had to be told, but I didn't know how. But I also believe that not to transmit an experience is to betray it. This is what my tradition, the Jewish tradition, teaches us. But how do you do this? The Book of Splendor, the Zohar, says when Israel is in exile, so is the world. Language is in exile. Language itself is uprooted. Which means that the word has deserted the meaning it was intended to convey. And one can no longer make them coincide. The displacement, the uprootedness, the shift is irrevocable. And this was never more true than right after the upheaval, which was some 50 years ago. We all knew that we could never say what had to be said, that we could never express in words, coherent, intelligible words, our experience of madness on an absolute scale. The walk through fiery nights, the silence before and after a selection, the toneless praying of the condemned, the Kaddish of the dying, the fear and hunger of the sick, the shame and suffering, the haunted eyes, the wild stares. I thought that I would never be able to speak of them. All words seemed inadequate, worn, foolish, lifeless, pale, whereas I wanted them to sear. And that's why I write. Maybe I write to wrest victims from oblivion, to help the dead vanquish death. And in general, in every one of my novels, to those of you who are kind enough to read some of them, in every one of them there is always a child, always an old man, and always a madman. Why these categories? I'll tell you. Because these categories were the first targets. Whenever the enemy arrived anywhere, the children were the first. And the children, therefore, have been my obsessions. When I think of my life, each time I espouse the cause for human rights, and God knows I have tried to espouse as many as I could, it always began with a child. The photo of a child, words of a child, seeing a dying child in the arms of his or her mother in Biafra, dying of hunger. Seeing a child in Bosnia, seeing a child in Rwanda. And each time I see these children, I say to myself, my God, Dostoevsky is right. When he says that the death of one child recalls into question God's very existence. But what about our existence as members of the human family? What are we doing? And it is therefore the children, always the children. I say to myself, since they were then denied shelter, life, a future, name, a destiny, I will take a child, at least one, and offer this child an address, a roof over his or her head. So you have a child. But the same is true of old people, a strange generation. Usually, after a war in the past, those who remained were children or old people, because those who were between a certain age, 18, 30 or 40, they went to war. And many of them were killed. But the children were saved, the old men was, the women were saved, they had refuge. After this war, from 1939 to 45, just the opposite. The children and the old men and women, they vanished. And only those who were lucky enough, what we call today, I don't know, the middle age, 20, 30, 40, who were strong enough. But they were ageless. In every one of them there was a child who somehow didn't grow. In every one of them was an old person who already died and survived only in that person. And of course the madman. Again, the first, even before the great tragedy began, when the euthanasia program began. And that was not against Jews, it was really against sick people, desperate people, helpless people. And they then created, you know, the program of euthanasia. They would take them into their cars and bring them to a so-called hospital and kill them because they were mad. In those times, it was really maybe mad. You had to be mad to believe in humanity, to believe in the humanity of the human being. And therefore, I take a madman in my own. In this, the topic is uprootedness, and I always ask myself, who is uprooted, really? Who is uprooted? Someone who left his or her home, familiar surroundings and culture? That is an uprooted person. Is it someone who lost his or her fortune, position, and or social habits, a status? Or someone who was deprived of his or her right to have a normally happy childhood, a certain measure of hope in a future not threatened by brutality and hatred? Is a heretic uprooted? Is a believer turned heretic even more uprooted? Is a heretic turned believer uprooted? Is a madman necessarily uprooted simply because he or she chose to dwell in a different reality, either unnecessarily hostile or absurdly hospitable? What about reality? The enemy who hates Jews hates all people. I believe in hatred being a cancer. He who hates Jews hates others as well. The black and the Hispanics, the minorities, all kinds of minorities. Hatred has no boundaries. The hater doesn't look for the ID card of the person. He hates. And once he starts hating, doesn't stop. He began with Jews. He didn't stop with Jews. And hatred, therefore, has become, I think, today, because hatred is the basis for the fanatic terrorist, the suicide killer, really, the assassin, who kills himself in order to kill more people. He is threatening the world. We have seen it. It began with the suicide killings in Jerusalem and Israel. At that time, the world really didn't care that much. The world wasn't moved. It's only Jews. It began with Jews, and now it's anywhere. Even in Jordan, and in Morocco, and in Spain, and in Italy, and in France, it goes all over the world now. Unless we stop it, then things changed. It means everything changed. The uprootedness has taken hold of history. Once upon a time, war was only waged on the front line, but those who were behind the front lines were safe. Today, and the Second World War, it was the civilians too suffered because of the bombings. Today, the front line is everywhere. Every street is front line, in every city. And so, because of this, we all feel uprooted. And because of this, I believe, whatever we can, we must do in order to stop that hatred. You ask me for an answer, how? I don't know how. I am very good at questions and answers, I'm afraid I'm not so good. But one thing I do know, and since we are speaking, after all, within the structure of pedagogy, of learning, where we try to celebrate the passion for learning, the beauty of learning, the fact that learning brings people together, people who learn together cannot become enemies. Whatever the answer is to hatred, and to that hatred, education must be its major component. There is no substitute, only education. And the priority should be education. If I had the ear of the President of the United States, I would advise him surely to organize an emergency conference on hatred. And the basis should be, the outgoing basis should be really, how can we use education to redeem our fate and our hope and our humanity by disarming hatred, and if at all save ourselves from its poisonous arrows. So in my story, Gamliel is looking, and he is of course an exile, and he speaks about uprootedness, and he says Adam and Eve the first to be uprooted, the first exiles, the first stateless ones, driven out of the first family home, where life was beautiful even when it wasn't. Like them, Adam and Eve, their descendants today wander the earth, fleeing the serpent with its deadly poison. Others decide their faith. They are no longer free to act, to believe, to choose their places, nor even to renounce freedom. As in ancient Greece, where they were called apolis, they are considered harmful or dangerous, and so they are kept aside from humanity. All of us are like Adam, said the sage in antiquity, but not I, Gamaliel says to himself. I am not Adam. Eve is my mother, not my wife. And I want to protect the children, my own and all the others, from the world of my madness. Where are they growing up? In what accursed land, beset by what enemies? Why so much hatred? And what about himself, Gamaliel, the exile? He has done no harm, has taken nothing from others, hasn't seduced their women nor led their children astray, hasn't taken their place in the sun, and yet, why is he so unloved? Why do people he has never met shun the solitary intruder who carries his past like a load on his shoulders? For this is anti-Semitism. The anti-Semite hated me before I was born. The anti-Semite hates any Jew simply because this Jew is a Jew. And then he says, it's strange, the word refugee has lost its biblical meaning. The Bible provides for cities of refuge, where those who kill someone by accident can take shelter from avengers. Of course, the refugees are not entirely free of guilt, so Scripture specifies they must remain in these cities of asylum until their sin is expiated by the death of the high priest. And that is why, adds the Talmud, the refugees are so often visited by the mother of the high priest, who brings them clothing and sweets and fruits in the hope that if their lives are pleasant enough, they will not pray for her son's death. In our time, it's the innocent who need refuge, not the guilty. And therefore, when we speak of the uprooted person today, this is the uprootedness. It somehow has affected everyone who is today alive. Why? Because we live in an age of fear. Oh, of course, I know there was a great writer, he was a Bernard Shaw of France, named Tristan Bernard. Tristan Bernard was one of the greatest Jewish authors. So he wrote comic books, but great. And when the Germans came in, he was hiding. And then either he was discovered or he left his hiding place. And he was put on a bus or on a truck where he saw the other Jews who had been caught before. And when they saw him, they recognized him, and they saw him smiling. And he said, Maître, we mean, sir, you are smiling now? Do you know where we are? Where we are going? And he said, why shouldn't I? Until now, I lived in fear. From now on, I shall live in hope. I like this opposition, fear and hope. We have lived in fear, but we still live in fear. Where is hope to be found? Without hope, culture doesn't exist. Nothing exists. Without hope, humanity is lost. But where is hope to be found? In what world can we live today so as children would not be afraid of tomorrow? The world is uncertain, and admit it, the century had just begun. When the century ended in 1999, we were so optimistic. All of us were. I'll always remember it. 31st of December was a Friday. 31st of December, in the evening, at night, all over the world, jubilation, champagne, dancing in the street, fireworks. We were all convinced that the next century will be a better century. And you know what Paul Valéry once said? He said, at times you feel that the future isn't what it used to be. And in this case, again, it wasn't what it used to be. So we thought, what do you mean? 21st century? Finish. Go. 20th century, go away. We don't need you anymore. We don't want to hear from you again. And we are now 5 years into the century. So many acts of violence, so much hatred, and wars, and more wars, and more wars, and more suicides, and more weapons, and more... You know, I think of my generation that we thought that there are 1,000 ways of living, but we, on the contrary, discovered then there were 1,000 ways of dying, and we couldn't find the real way of living. And we have thought this century will give us that way. Come on, enough. We have learned. Have we? Even the meaning of war and peace has been, therefore, uprooted. So Gamaliel actually is a writer, and in order to write, he would read. And, of course, I believe in reading, as you know. All my students know that. They read a lot. They must read, because otherwise they wouldn't be in my class. And so I say that Gamaliel would read and reread the essential works of intellectual and spiritual life in the Middle Ages. He began with Europe, and then he focused his attention on Rome and Barcelona. Crescas and Pico della Mirandola, Averroes and Ibn Ezra, Maimonides, and of course Paritus the One-Eyed, that scholar whose imagination knew no bounds. How could one hear the voices of heaven? What was the true faith? And how could one recognize it? In those days, it was all too easy to fall into heresy. It was enough if you merely hesitated or stood out in the crowd of the faithful or refused to give the usual answers. Or if you said no, simply no. No to absolute power. No to the pitiless authority of the church. And no, 100 times no to dogmas. No to anything that denied freedom, even if you had to die for it or with it. So it was that Giordano Bruno appeared as a hero. He still is, because he died for it. But you know, we learned, and we didn't learn enough. Do you remember the Descartes, the great Descartes, without whom there would be no real modern philosophy? The Descartes had a book which he had not published, because he was afraid of the Inquisition. What about fear? In one of my courses, we read one of the great masterpieces of the 20th century called Life and Destiny by a man named Vasily Grossman. I plead with you, if you can read it. It's a great, great, great book. Depressing. Heartbreaking. But in that depression there is tremendous beauty as well. Why? And he describes actually the 20th century dominated by two totalitarian ideologies and movements, two powers, world powers, who brought evil and destruction to humanity. One was fascism and the other one was communism. And he writes as a communist, as a former communist. He used to be the correspondent, the war correspondent for the Red Star, the organ of the Red Army. But he then saw, and what is the extraordinary part is that in the Soviet Union, where Stalin in the early 50s has turned his entire empire into an organ of anti-Semitic propaganda, literally threatening the entire Jewish community, preparing a huge pogrom in Moscow after hanging 5 doctors, the famous doctor's plot, and sending all of them to Siberia, all the Jews. The camps were ready, the barracks were ready, the trains were ready. Thank God, he died before signing the decree. And Many of us believe that that was a kind of pathological attack on Stalin, that he became anti-Semitic. No. In the middle of the war, in 1942, during Stalingrad, during the siege of Stalingrad, there was anti-Semitism in the Red Army, in the sciences, anywhere. Somebody with a Jewish name was ostracized. His or her job was jeopardized. Many of them were arrested. Great scientists had lost their jobs because they were Jews during the war. So you wonder, my God, what happened then? It wasn't enough to have one totalitarian movement being anti-Semitic. There was the other one, which fought the first, also anti-Semitic. Then where are we going? Uprootedness. Everything was uprooted. The words, the concepts, the ideals perverted. And so, I wrote, therefore, this novel about uprootedness. I wrote it because I love stories, and here is a story. The man that I described, the beggar that I described in the beginning, Gamliel says, I have seen him once again, that wandering man who had come to our door ages ago, it seemed. This time it was in the mountain village where we had found ourselves after crossing the border of Czechoslovakia into Hungary. Did he know that we were about to move out and go to Budapest? Once again, it was on a Sabbath afternoon. Mother was asleep. My father was out. Night would soon fall. I was feeling lonely and sad. Suddenly the door opened. I started in fright. My father isn't home, I said to the man standing still in the doorway. I know that, he said. And I recognized that distinctive voice. You are the one I've come to see, he said. You like stories. You really love them, don't you? Yes, I do, I answered. Softly, yes. I love to hear stories, yes, always. Very well, then sit down and listen. Still standing, back to back with his motionless shadow, he told me the story of a Hasid, a humble disciple of the Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name, known as the Besht from his initials. The disciple was worried about how he would support his family after the death of the master. Well, that's simple enough, the Besht had said. You will travel the world telling the story of my deeds. Of course, the Hasid had no choice but to obey. With his sack over his shoulder, he went on foot from village to village, from one community to the next, from one home to the next, seeking those who were ready to hear him tell of the greatness of the master of the good name. Often people were too preoccupied. They would turn him away and go about their business. The best among them would give him a few copper coins as alms or for their own sins. And he would carefully put these away to take to his wife for Passover. Then one night that he spent in a forest, he lost his meager fortune just when he was due to go home the following week. Tears came to his eyes. And he was still in tears when he came to the synagogue in the neighboring village. Asked what his trouble was, he replied that he made his living by telling people stories about his master, that he had just lost all he had, and here it was almost Passover, and his family could not afford to celebrate the traditional Seder feast. The people of the community empathized with his plight, but being themselves almost as penniless as he, they could give him only a piece of advice. The lord of their village was rather peculiar, they said. He seldom went out. He was never seen in either the church or the tavern, but he would admit to the castle anyone who could tell him a story. If the story was new to him, the Lord would reward the teller handsomely. Let the Hasid try his luck with the Lord at his castle, they suggested. The Lord greeted him by saying, "They say you have some worthwhile Jewish tales in that head of yours. Is that right?" "Yes, it's true," the disciple replied. "Then what are you waiting for? Go ahead." The disciple and the late servant of the Besht began to tell of his master's travels, how he would disappear only to reappear in faraway places, how he conjured up the miracles his master had performed, how he saved a desperate woman, freed a helpless merchant from prison, rescued a widow, an orphan about to die, a child stolen by evil priests. After each story, the lord of the village would give him a small coin and say, "Go on." So passed that day and all the next day also. At last, the storyteller fell silent. "That's all I can remember," he said. "Try," the Lord said bleakly. "Search your memory. Go on, make an effort." "I did try. There is nothing there." "Then try again," the Lord insisted. "Try harder. You won't regret it." "I can't do it," said the Hasid sadly. Without a word, the Lord led him to the gate, where the disciple suddenly stopped, slapped his forehead and exclaimed, "Please forgive me, but it's just come back to me. I remember a young sinner who came to the Besht to ask for his help and his advice. He had strayed too far from the right path. He had broken with his God and with his people. He had done terrible things, unforgivable things, and now he wanted with all his heart to find the path of righteousness. How could he find his way there? The Besht asked me to leave the room. He wanted to be alone with the visitor. And after a few hours, he called me back. It seems that before leaving, the young penitent had asked the Besht, "How will I know whether my repentance has been accepted?" And the Besht had replied, "You will know it on the day then this story is told to you." And the Lord had tears in his eyes as he embraced the disciple who proceeded home, his pockets stuffed, and celebrated the Seder amid the joy of his memories. I love stories. Once upon a time, I published a novel called The Gates of the Forest, where I told the story of the four masters who had all foreseen misfortune. And the Besht, and the Magid of Mezerich, and the Israel of Koshnitz, and the Moshe Leib Sassover, and all of them, and the Besht knew the prayer, and the place, and how to light the fire, and went on from generation to generation. And at the end of the story, I simply added, God created man because he loved stories. Except, I wrote he, the lowercase. And I got so many inquiries. He who loves stories, God or we? Maybe both of us. Both God and his creatures. The problem or the question is, are they the same stories? The stories told to us or the stories told by us? In other words, one of my obsessive questions is, man God's failure? And what about God to man? Is he our dream? Is he our nightmare? Are we his nightmare? In these questions that of course reflect the strange and obsessive relationship between creature and creator, between us and God, if you believe in God, or in destiny if you don't. What is all that? Who is telling stories to whom? And what are the stories really about and about whom? And when will the stories end? When will they change? When will they approve in telling? Once you told the story, what happens then? Can you tell it again? I describe here, actually, in a secret book, I describe a meeting between a master, a mystical master, and the cardinal and archbishop. And I describe the mystical master, his life. His name was Hananel, and there was nothing else to do in those times. The children of Israel had been too long in exile. They could bear no more. The ordeal was too much. The enemy was too powerful. His designs too cruel. And the prophet Elijah was too far away. The descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob could no longer hold out. Thus, the master and his young disciple entered on a perilous ascetic journey known for its traps and obstacles. Isolated from the world, even from their families, they lived for 3 times 3 weeks in a shack at the edge of the forest overlooking the village. They followed a program of study, of intense meditation, of prolonged fasting, of prescribed prayers, of litanies recited without moving the lips, all this while standing in a state of concentration that would leave them dizzy. Ritual bath, morning and night, chanting at midnight, carefully preparing themselves to penetrate walls, to set on fire their minds and souls and time itself. They dealt with unnameable sacrifices and ordeals performed according to rules set down in the esoteric and difficult texts of the Kabbalah. Sometimes the old Rebbe would shake himself and urge his disciple on, "Faster, my son, we must run faster, we must climb higher. Every minute counts, the danger is taking shape, the angel of death and destruction is approaching, the blood of Jews will flow, it is flowing already, only the Messiah can stop it, only he can save our people." But Satan, the cursed devil, was on alert. He never sleeps. And he was plotting his victory. The old master thought that by being hasty he was serving God, when in fact he was opposing his will. He was wrong. The universe of the Kabbalah has its own rhythm, its own method. Haste is dangerous. A word spoken too soon, a name invoked too late, these can jeopardize the entire endeavor by pushing humanity to the side of evil and its destructive power. And that is what happened. The last stage in the ritual took place at dawn in the forest. It consisted of calling out the name of the angel Metatron 71 times, each time louder than the last, to the point of rapture. Then the ineffable name 21 times, then 26 times more, then reciting 7 times a prayer known only to the high priest. Well, the master and his disciples were ready. They were wearing their prayer shawls as they began the ceremony. And then a torrential rain started to fall from the dark, heavy clouds. They continued despite the rain. Now thunder and lightning took their turn, striking at the earth. Still they persisted in spite of the lightning, in spite of the thunder. Then during a pause in the storm, a huge wild dog appeared out of nowhere. It was black as the night, the biggest dog they had ever seen. It was foaming with rage, and its baying was louder, more deafening than the thunder itself. Jaws open, it was about to hurl itself on the two men and tear them to pieces. "Go on," the old master cried out. "That beast was sent by Satan to frighten us, to weaken our resolve. We must continue, it's our only chance." But the disciple was afraid, and he lost his concentration. In a moment, the dog was upon them. The old master was knocked down, so was Hananel, but he survived his wounds, although his master did not. The Jewish community of the village mourned the old master. His funeral procession stretched over streets and alleys. The old women cried their lamentation. Young students wept unashamedly. Schools closed so their students could attend the funeral. Some said it was foolish to violate what is forbidden. And others replied, it was foolish, but it was also holy. So, it's always too late or too early, who knows. But the fact is, the Messiah did not come. And so in conclusion, I'll tell you another story, a better one, on the more uplifting on that subject. The story is again the Baal Shem Tov was praying. And he decided to call all of his disciples, and he had a group of very faithful disciples, all were great scholars and erudite and pure, mystically pure, morally pure, ethically pure, humanly pure in everything, pure of anything that was unholy. And they did what they had to do. And he gave them a date. After a week, they would meet in the morning at the first light, just at the first light, at a certain place in the forest. And there they would light the fire. And then they would say their prayer. And the Messiah will come. It was clear. Everything was prearranged. They were all there except Marshentov, except the Besh, the master himself, the founder of the movement. They were waiting and waiting, yet he wasn't there. He came 2 hours later. And they were, the students, the disciples were scared. Maybe they did it wrong. And he said, no, it's not your fault. It's mine. He told them what happened. He said, look, I was ready. Everything was ready. I knew in heaven was ready too. Except on the way here, remember that little street leading to the forest? All of a sudden I stopped because I heard a child cry. I couldn't help it. The child is crying. I had to go in and reassure the child. Be with the child whose mother wasn't there. She must have gone somewhere. You see, when a child cries, the Messiah must wait. Let's wait together. Thank you.
You've just heard the last of three lectures in the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled The Time of the Uprooted. Introducing Professor Wiesel was the director of the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation, Rabbi Joseph Pollack. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skobe, with help from Mike Toda. Our web producer is Angel Cozzelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.